Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. A recent headline in the Washington Post said, "Dead baby becomes the most tragic symbol yet of the Mediterranean refugee crisis." NPR's headline was, "Image of dead Syrian child shakes up media coverage of refugee crisis." The dead baby they're talking about was 3-year-old Elon Kurdi. By now, you've probably seen or read about the photos of his body washed up onto a Turkish beach. His 5-year-old brother, Galip, also drowned. Several media reports are focusing on how journalists are handling these kinds of images. Over the past few weeks, there have been several stories focusing on the humanitarian crisis. But with so much focus on the humanitarian angle, where is the political analysis about why so many people are fleeing Syria and who should be held responsible? Joining us to talk about coverage is Chris Tenzing, Executive Director of the Middle East Research and Information Project Journal. Hi, Chris. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. And on the domestic front, President Obama is making headlines for becoming the first sitting U.S. president to visit the Arctic during his 3-day trip to Alaska. At the same time, he recently gave Shell the green light to drill for oil and gas in the Arctic. Environmental groups are calling this climate hypocrisy. Credo Mobile points out that the president has also approved the southern portion of the Keystone Pipeline, proposed to mine another 10 billion tons of coal in Wyoming, secretly approved a massive expansion of the Alberta Clipper tar sands pipeline, and proposed to open the East Coast to offshore oil drilling. A Mother Jones piece picked up on the hypocrisy with this September 1st headline, "Obama is a climate hypocrite. His trip to Alaska proves it." Joining us to talk about coverage of this is Kate Shepard, senior reporter and environment and energy editor at the Huffington Post. Her recent piece is called "In Alaska, Obama Highlights Climate Change While His Decisions Draw Accusations of Hypocrisy." Hi, Kate. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Antonia Yuhas, an oil and energy expert, award-winning investigative journalist, and author of 3 books. Her latest is Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Antonia was in Wainwright, Alaska in July. It's the closest village to Shell's drilling in the Arctic. And Antonia joins me in studio. Hi, Antonia. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off by highlighting really good journalism this week. So why don't we start off with you, Antonia? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
There are a couple things, but I would say Jennifer Dooley, I think I'm pronouncing her name correctly, of the Houston Chronicle, did a very good piece looking at Freedom of Information Act requests, looking at the problems that the Coast Guard identified with Shell's drilling rigs while they were in Seattle and in Hawaii, basically finding that Shell's employees weren't prepared and weren't ready for fires. They had problems with pollution equipment, and that the Coast Guard basically said, you know, they were unprepared for these drills. And part of the problem was that they were new, so they weren't familiar with the equipment. And I thought that was a really excellent piece. And then we can talk about more the reporting I actually found the most, reporting in quotation marks, I found the most fascinating from the president's visit was the president's own reporting himself.
Oh, the video that he put out?
All of the stuff he did.
Yeah.
He did an amazing job of covering Instagram, Twitter, Medium. It was totally fascinating and definitely something to talk about more.
Yeah, he was walking around with a selfie stick and doing videos showing people
GoPro.
How beautiful.
Yeah, more than that. More than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We'll talk about that. And just quickly on this Houston Chronicle piece, the FOIA request, how did this reporter get this information? Where did it come from?
I'm not sure. I think it's possible that the Freedom of Information Act requests were done by Greenpeace and I think perhaps Oil Change International, but it wasn't clear in the article.
Okay.
But she also showed the documents in her piece. So it was a very well reported piece.
And this is the equipment that is now in the Arctic?
The rigs.
The same.
Yeah. The Polar Pioneer drilling rig and the Noble Discoverer rig as well.
All right. So kudos to Jennifer Dooley with the Houston Chronicle. And we will link to that right after the show. That is Antonia Yuhas, an award-winning investigative journalist. And what about you, Kate? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'm going to go a little bit off my main beat and say the piece I really liked that was in Aeon magazine this week. It was from Suji Cagel. She's an illustrator and writer, and she's a really great piece looking at Utah's plan for housing homeless people and getting them off the streets basically by giving them homes. Mm. I thought it was a really interesting story. I think it was great because it was about potential solutions, and I also loved that it was an illustrated piece as well as a reported piece that is really makes the issue come alive. And this is an issue that not what I write about, but it's an issue that I'm passionate about beyond my day-to-day work. So I thought it was a really great piece to highlight.
And this was in Aeon magazine?
Aeon? A-E-O-N. I've never actually said that word out loud.
Okay. Yeah, I've never heard of that one, but Suji Cagel does amazing illustrative work on political issues.
She's great.
And we did a show about this, actually, about a month or two ago, about how Utah is planning to house the homeless, and you can find that at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for that. That is Kate Shepard, reporter with the Huffington Post. And what about you, Chris? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, speaking about the Mediterranean refugee crisis, in addition to all the coverage of the Syrian refugees who are fleeing that route, one of the forgotten refugee populations in the world is the huge Eritrean refugee population, many of whom also make that perilous voyage across the Mediterranean Sea to reach asylum in mainland Europe. And there was a absolutely wrenching multimedia presentation in the New York Times Magazine this week. It's still up. The photos and video are by Paolo Pellegrin. I can't remember off the top of my head who wrote the accompanying text, but it's basically video footage and photos and also some text. I think the reporters were right there in a dinghy or a boat alongside the very small fishing boat that was carrying what looks like 50 to 75 Eritrean refugees, without any cover over their heads, just in the sun, packed in like sardines into the boat. The boat is obviously unseaworthy, not fit to cross a major body of water. And it tells the story of these refugees, and they did in fact have a harrowing experience. Fortunately, they were rescued in the end and brought to mainland Italy, but not before some pretty scary experiences. And some of their relatives and friends in a neighboring boat did not make it across the sea. So the multimedia presentation, I think, brings home even more just the sheer scale of the human displacement that is happening as a result of war and political turmoil and political oppression and also endemic poverty across the Middle East, North Africa, and also Sub-Saharan Africa.
And Chris, in that piece, was there information about the politics behind why so many people are fleeing?
You know, that was something missing. I'm glad you brought that up, that there wasn't much about what generates the refugee problem in Eritrea in particular. Mm. And the answer is that it's one of the most oppressive governments in the world. They have this mandatory military service where all men and women under a certain age have to do years and years of service to the state. It's a highly militarized state, one of the most militarized states in the world. So it's a one-party state that controls almost all forms of freedom of expression, controls religion, all kinds of things. And there are some terrific background pieces that have been written over the years by the vice chair of our board of directors, actually, Dan Connell, who has a long history as a reporter in the Horn of Africa. And all of those articles are accessible on our website. And Dan does a great job of getting into the politics in Eritrea that caused this terrible refugee problem.
And didn't President Obama visit Eritrea recently for the African summit?
He did.
Mm-hmm. And did he bring up any of these issues?
Not with much gusto, no.
All right, so kudos to the New York Times for this piece about the refugee crisis in Eritrea, and we will put links at yourcallradio.org. That is Chris Tenzing. He is with the Middle East Research and Information Project. So, Chris, since you brought up media coverage of the refugee crisis, I wanted to ask you what you think of what's happening. Actually, Antonia, you tweeted a really good piece from the Washington Post. I mean, these numbers are astounding. In 2011, Syria's population was 22.4 million people, 22.4 million. Today, more than half are either dead, displaced, or exiled.
That's a piece from Human Rights Watch, actually. They've been doing amazing work. And was it posted in the Washington Post as well?
Maybe the Washington Post cited
picked
this
up.
Piece.
Okay.
But yeah, the Washington Post has an extensive piece based on this report.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this is obviously an enormous crisis. I guess picking up on where you had started in the opening with the horrific image, you know, I think the image was critically important. I think people have also been, you know, I know personally I've been extremely impacted by my family's Hungarian. My family are Holocaust survivors from Hungary, and seeing people, you know, squished into trains in Hungary, being sent off to camps that they don't want to go to, has been a pretty shocking image, and I think particularly for Europeans as well. The thing that I've been thinking about the most, though, is the difference between the way that consumers take in these images, moving, you know, if you're just going through a Twitter feed and suddenly you see the image of the 3-year-old boy pass through, and then you keep going and it's Justin Bieber, and then you keep going and it's something else. And the way most of our major news coverage is also very similarly done, you know, a blip on a screen on the television news in particular, and then, you know, no context. And thinking about how people take in this information and the critical importance of filling in that story, because otherwise it's just, you know, emotional and visual bombardment that people, I would imagine most consumers would just pass on, because there's no way that you can watch through a Twitter feed or watch through a Facebook feed and really deal emotionally and intellectually and politically and socially with that story without the opportunity to take in the whole issue. And I've been comparing that with the images from the Vietnam War of the young woman, a naked woman running, the child running after being hit with napalm, and thinking about the way journalism consumers were viewing that image. And it was primarily, you know, on television as part of a longer news story about the war. There was a shared consumption because there was, you know, limited news available. And so most people were watching the same news story and taking in the same image and thinking about it and talking about it and having a longer conversation about it and seeing it within the context of a war that they knew about and have been thinking about. And I compare that to how I first saw this, the image of the 3-year-old Syrian boy, which was on my Twitter feed. And the critical importance for us as journalists to have to go through a lot more hurdles to have to fill in that full story so that we take it from a shock, a bombardment of image, to something that people can potentially actually do something about.
Well, and the Independent said it has taken the decision to publish the images because among the often glib words about the, quote, ongoing migrant crisis, it's all too easy to forget the reality of the desperate situation facing many refugees.
Yeah, but if it only comes to us through a shocking image that then gets passed through without a full news coverage, to me, that could almost do more harm than good.
Chris, what are your thoughts on that?
I agree that the use of the image is a little troubling. To start with, it's troubling that it takes a very stark image like that of an innocent child, somebody who can't possibly be blamed for anything that happens to him, to sort of shock the world's conscience into realizing the scope of this problem. This is not a new, this the Mediterranean refugee crisis is not new, and it's as I said earlier, it's not just Syrians, although Syrians are a major component of it. It's people from North Africa, from Sub-Saharan Africa, from the Middle East, Iraq, Palestinians even, and so I mean, we're facing the largest wave of human displacement, forced human displacement, since World War II, because of the conflagration in that area of the world. It's dismaying, to say the least, that it has taken a particularly gruesome incident like this to sort of shock the media into giving it such a full-court press coverage.
Chris Tenzing is Executive Director of the Middle East Research and Information Project. Antonia Juhas is an award-winning investigative journalist and author of 3 books. Her latest is Black Tide. Kate Shepard is Senior Reporter and Environment and Energy Editor at the Huffington Post. And we are talking today on Your Calls Media Roundtable about the refugee crisis. We're also going to talk about the Saudi Arabian King's visit to Washington, D.C. What really strikes you about the coverage that you have seen? There have been so many heart-wrenching stories about the refugee crisis, images. You've heard the voices of people if you've listened to NPR and the BBC. And beyond the humanitarian angle, what about the politics behind this? Have you heard or read much analysis about why this is happening? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Chris, what strikes you about how different countries are responding? Agence France-Presse is reporting that Hungary's parliament pushed through emergency anti-migration laws today to halt a surge in numbers crossing into the EU state as crowds of refugees and migrants defied the security forces in their quest to reach Western Europe. This new measure includes 3-year jail terms for people climbing over a newly built razor wire fence on the 110-mile border with Serbia.
Yeah, the response of the southern tier EU states in general has been shameful. Going back years now, they have treated the migration crisis as primarily a security problem that they have, rather than a humanitarian issue. To say nothing of trying to do something to solve the political conflicts and redress the severe economic crises that are the long-term drivers of the mass flight and the mass displacement. The northern tier EU countries have been a little bit better. I mean, Germany has of course been made the news this past week for suspending the Dublin regulations that allow strictures on passage from one EU country to another. I have to say the United States has not exactly been a shining light unto the world with regard to the Syrian refugee problem. And it reminds us of how few Iraqi refugees the United States took, despite the fact that it led the so-called coalition that achieved the utter despoilation of that country in the last decade. This past month, Secretary Kerry announced that the U.S. is going to be taking 8,000 Syrian refugees, which is, you know, a tiny number compared to the need and compared to how many we could take. The other countries whose record is pretty shameful is the wealthy Arab Gulf states, Saudi Arabia and its neighboring petroprincedoms, who are complicit in a lot of ways in this refugee crisis. If we look at Syria, a lot of the funding that is driving the in various insurgencies against the regime of Bashar al-Assad, up to and including al-Qaeda and even some elements of ISIS, is coming from those countries, whether private or even quasi-governmental elements in those countries. So they are fueling the war and meanwhile accepting not a single refugee from the Syrian conflict. Qatar and the Saudis are also pumping money into keeping the camps in Jordan and so on stocked with supplies. But in terms of either addressing the political roots of the conflict or in terms of meeting the full extent of their humanitarian aid responsibility, their record has been absolutely shameful.
And so Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Oman, and Bahrain, they have all offered zero resettlement places.
Zero. my understanding. Yeah, that's according to something that Human Rights Watch put out yesterday, yes.
What are your thoughts at this time? The King of Saudi Arabia is going to be visiting Washington, D.C. Do you think that this will come up in off-the-record conversations between the King and President Obama? Or he's here. I'm sorry. He's here now.
It may come up. I think the primary subject of their discussions is probably going to be the nuclear deal with Iran. And the U.S., unfortunately, the Obama administration is very solicitous of its Saudi strategic partner and the anxieties of the Saudis about the perceived increased regional hegemony of Iran that will be supposedly enhanced by this deal. The U.S., of course, is keen to keep its strategic partnership with Saudi Arabia as well as its partnership with Israel intact as this deal goes forward. I think that's job one for President Obama. I hope that they're not just talking about a political solution to the conflict in Syria and addressing the humanitarian needs of Syrian refugees, but I hope that they're also talking about Yemen, which is another country that would be producing a vast flow of refugees were Yemenis able to get out. There is a terrible naval blockade of Yemen that is, again, enforced by the Arab Gulf states, Saudi Arabia chief among them, which is preventing desperate, hungry, thirsty Yemenis from escaping the war that is ravaging their country. So far, the Obama administration, I believe, as a sort of tacit quid pro quo for the Saudis not stamping their feet too loudly about Iran, is sort of basically outsourcing U.S. policy on Yemen to the Saudis and giving the Saudis and their so-called coalition a free hand in bombing that country and now invading it.
The New York Times headline was, Iran deal will top agenda when Saudi king visits White House. What are your thoughts, Chris, about the timing of this visit?
Last month there was, the Obama administration, starting its efforts to persuade its Arab Gulf partners to be acquiescent in this deal, had a summit at Camp David, I think, and King Salman of Saudi Arabia was the only Gulf head of state who pointedly did not attend. It was taken at the time as a snub, as a sign of the Saudis' displeasure with the U.S. And so this visit is supposed to signal that all is well. It also comes, of course, in advance of the congressional vote here on the deal. And I think it's, pretty carefully choreographed to show that that the Saudis, at least, whatever the Israelis may think, the Saudis at least are not going to, turn around and ally themselves with China and instead of us because of this deal. It has a domestic U.S. audience in that regard.
And Chris, just quickly, if there was a press conference, what questions do you think reporters should be asking on this issue?
On which issue?
The Iran with the Saudi King and President Obama about the Iran deal.
What they should ask President Obama is why it's necessary to essentially bribe Saudi Arabia and Israel with massive amounts of military boodle just because we are party to an agreement with another country in the region that advances our interests and world peace. What we've essentially done is promised both Israel and the Saudis and its Arab Gulf neighbors massive amounts of military aid, which essentially amounts to a bribe to them for not exercising the full extent of their political muscle here to stop the deal. Why is it that our policy is so compromised by these two strategic partnerships in the region?
Well, we're out of time for this segment, but Chris, we're going to definitely do an entire show on the refugee crisis, and we'd love to have you back. Chris Tenzing is Executive Director of the Middle East Research and Information Project. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
The This is Your Call on KALW, local public radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll rebroadcast a conversation we had about Connected by Coffee, a great documentary about the lives and history of the people who grow coffee. Over a billion cups of coffee are consumed every day around the globe. The industry is worth over $100 billion, but most rural coffee growers live in poverty. So what can we do to support farmers using fairly traded coffee as a tool for social justice? That's on Monday. Tuesday, we will speak with Ari Berman about his new book, focusing on voting rights and attacks on voting rights. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, and we are going to talk about President Obama's trip to the Arctic. He's received a lot of attention because he is the first sitting U.S. president to visit the Arctic. It was on a three-day trip to Alaska. We're talking about that with Kate Shepard, senior reporter and environment and energy editor at the Huffington Post, and Antonia Yuhas, award-winning investigative journalist, author of three books, including Black Tide. So, Kate, your headline sort of said it all. In Alaska, Obama highlights climate change while his decisions draw accusations of hypocrisy. And Antonia mentioned the videos that the White House put out, and Credo Mobile did a really good job of taking that video and putting their own text on it, saying, well, yes, it's great that you're going to the Arctic, but you're also allowing Shell to drill. So how did you decide to go about covering this big issue and the environmentalists calling it climate hypocrisy?
Well, I've been covering the decision to let Shell drill in the Arctic quite a bit for a while, and I know that environmental groups are mad about that. But they're happy that Obama was going up to Alaska because there's a lot of important climate issues to talk about in Alaska, and they're happy to see him shining a light on it. But I think that you really couldn't get away with telling a story about him going to Alaska without mentioning that, because it's become a huge issue, I think, for environmental groups to say, this is a mixed message that they're sending on climate change if you say drilling is okay, but also we should stop drilling. So I don't think I could cover the trip without mentioning that.
Right. And then also, how does the work of the environmental groups affect your coverage? Because clearly Credo put a lot of work into that video. I mean, not only talking about the Arctic, but also some of his other policies, that he's approving the southern portion of Keystone, proposing to mine another 10 billion tons of coal in Wyoming, proposing to open the East Coast to offshore oil drilling. I mean, the list is really long.
I think it's absolutely true that Obama has a number of different policies that support fossil fuels in a lot of different ways, and I think that often gets lost as you see people attacking his climate plan and saying that, Obama's anti-fossil fuels. But if you look at a lot of things that the administration has done, they've supported fossil fuel development in a number of ways. And it's one of the things I think people attack Obama for it now, but Obama was supportive of these things when he was a senator as well. So it's not like it's uncharacteristic of him. I think the administration really does believe the rhetoric they put out there about an all-of-the-above energy policy that includes all the things, including oil and gas and coal, and a lot of the policies that they've put out there that support that.
Antonia, President Obama, before heading to Alaska, said that even as we accelerate the transition to renewables, our economy still has to rely on oil and gas. As long as that's the case, he said, I believe we should rely more on domestic production than on foreign imports. So how do you think the media are dealing with Obama's environmental policies and record?
Well, I mean, I think let's focus in on the trip to Alaska first. I mean, I think that was in his radio address on the Saturday before he departed for Alaska, where he did, basically what he did throughout the trip, which was he made a very powerful statement on climate change. I think overall the press tended to do a pretty good job, which was to say, which was to follow him around Alaska and to say, and to cover the very important things he said about these are you know, the real effects of climate change, which we are experiencing right now, which are hurting real people and real places, and here they are. And at the exact same time, he had, he just put on full display his schizophrenic approach to this issue, which is continuing Bush administration policies, which have led the United States to almost its highest record of domestic production in our entire history, and bringing the United States to a place where we are the world's largest producer of oil and natural gas combined. And that's the result of policies that said, you know, basically go anywhere, drill anywhere at any time. And so the sort of schizophrenia, which I felt like, you know, when you listen to Obama's radio address, which he gave, and then the videos that he put out. So he just did this, he and the administration did this remarkable job of creating their own media, which, you know, instead of using, for example, the White House website, on they use the Medium website. So it felt much more sort of homey and chummy and popular, and used Instagram and used Twitter. And the president did his own photos and his own videos, where he did these short videos that were him telling his story. And he was charming and charismatic and smart and, you know, very engaging to watch. And it was masterful. But, you know, of course, he didn't talk about Shell drilling except for in very strange moments. So he got to tell his own story, which was about climate, which is what I believe he genuinely, you know, went there to raise concern about in advance of the Paris United Nations climate talks in December, where I believe that he hopes to see a binding agreement reached. But at the same time, the administration has advocated increased production of fossil fuels. So one of the most ironic moments was when he was in Bristol Bay, Alaska, talking about how the administration believes that it's important to protect communities from drilling, from oil drilling, which it has, which he has in Bristol Bay, yet, you know, failed to go up to the actual area of the Arctic where Shell is now drilling. And so he talked about the importance of protecting communities from drilling while at the same time going and advocating new drilling in one of the most dangerous places in the world. And I actually think that most media coverage, you know, it was I think it was impossible to cover this story without talking about both of those things. But I would say that the preponderance of media coverage was simply taking the material that the president put out himself. Hmm. And that was fairly fascinating to watch. Although, you know, I mean, as I said, you know, I think most media outlets did at least one story that was looking at, you know, both the hypocrisy and I really do think schizophrenia is the more appropriate word, of increasing drilling at the same time as talking about climate change. Also, I mean, just this argument that, you know, we need to be more dependent on domestic supplies. It's really spurious. I mean, you know, it's a global market for oil. The United States is currently awash in oil, as is the globe at this moment. There's more supply than there is demand. United States producers are already exporting oil out through Canada and Mexico and are trying to get the export ban to be able to export out from wherever they want lifted. That's because they have too much product in the United States. They want to get it out to sell on a global market. Mm-hmm. And they already are. I mean, they already are exporting out oil and gasoline as a refined product more and more and more and more. So it's a really spurious argument. It was him just trying to, you know, reach somewhere. And the other spurious argument was that it was a Bush administration decision and therefore there's nothing we can do about it. That's just completely erroneous. For one thing, his administration can and should determine that it's not safe. But secondly, the administration can put in place a moratorium as it has in other places.
Antonia Yuhas is an investigative journalist, author of three books, including Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. She was in Wainwright in July, which is the closest village to Shell's drilling in the Arctic. Kate Shepard is a senior reporter and environment and energy editor with The Huffington Post. She previously reported for Mother Jones. And we're talking about media coverage of President Obama's visit to the Arctic, along with his environmental policies. What did you make of President Obama's trip? Did you see some of his social media photos. He wrote a long piece on Medium. He tweeted a beautiful photo of Denali. Mount McKinley was renamed Denali, which means the high one, restoring its native name. That happened last week also. What questions do you have about media coverage? What really struck you about what you read and heard this week? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Kate, what did you think about the White House really utilizing social media? I was just looking at his Medium article along with all of these gorgeous photos that he put up on Twitter and Instagram. What are your thoughts about how reporters use that?
I thought that that their use of social media was great, and I think, as Antonia pointed out, inspired a lot of other stories as well. I saw one in the Washington Post today that was focusing on just one picture he put up on Instagram that showed you the Alaska coast and how these villages are set up and why they're so vulnerable to climate change, and I thought that was great. I think the most important part of the trip is that sort of cascading influence of the White House's own use of social media, but also all the stories that came out of it. I think Alaska can feel really far away to people, and I think people are generally unaware of the climate impacts up there. I was up there about a year ago for a story about climate change and what's happening to these villages, and yeah, I thought it was great that we saw this sort of flood of stories about this now, and I think people are much more aware of it than they were before the president went up there. So I thought that was a good use on their part of social media and getting the word out.
So let's talk a little bit about what you both found while you were up there. Kate, your piece, Climate Change Takes a Village, As the Planet Warms, a Remote Alaskan Town Shows Just How Unprepared We Are. You report that the remote village of Shismaref in Alaska has been experiencing the effects of climate change firsthand. In the last decades, the island shores have been eroding into the sea, falling off in giant chunks whenever a big storm hits. What does this area look like?
I mean, it's basically a small coastal barrier island up the toward the north of Alaska. It's not as far north as you can get in Alaska, but it's pretty far up there. It's this tiny island that's been eroding away for years and years. They voted more than a decade ago to relocate, but they've found that it's a lot more difficult to do than they thought it might be. And I wish that Obama had made it quite that far up there. They made it to some impacted villages, but not quite as remote as Shismaref. But I think they did call attention to the plight of these villages, even if they still haven't really fixed the problem, which is that there's no government agency that's in charge of climate relocation right now. There are various different patches and programs that can be thrown at these communities, but there's no one that's coordinating it. There's no one that's helping a town of 400 people figure out how do you relocate. And I think the administration sort of teased at that issue on this trip, but it's still something that really needs to be solved.
And talk about how common this story is in Alaska. You report that everything on the island must be shipped in. As a result, fresh food, aside from what they can hunt or pick, is rare. Prices at the stores are outrageous, for example.
Yeah, I for people who live on the mainland of the U.S., it's hard to wrap your mind around. But there are these villages like this where, you know, there's basically nothing there other than houses, so it's not like you could just sort of pick up and move a few blocks away. You have to pick up and move an entire village, and it's not just Shismaref. There's more than a dozen villages that have voted to relocate because of climate change impacts, and more than 70 that are affected in some way that might need to relocate. So it's a fairly widespread challenge in Alaska.
You report that the beaches near this village and in this village are rapidly disappearing, and then also looking at what Alaska is facing, average temperatures are increasing faster in Alaska than they are in the rest of the U.S., warming 3.4 degrees Fahrenheit just in the last 50 years.
Yes, I think that was lost in a lot of this coverage in the lower 48 last year about what a cold winter we had here. Alaska had a really hot winter. They feel the impacts much more than we do because they're at a higher altitude. This summer we're seeing record wildfires in parts of Alaska as well, and so Alaska really is this sort of harbinger of what's to come for a lot of other places when we look at climate change.
And you recently, Antonia, visited Wainwright, which is the closest village to Shell's drilling in the Arctic. And what did you see? I mean, what does that area look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that was, you know, made it possible for the president to do the best that he could to avoid talking about Shell for example, was that he didn't go anywhere up near the Chukchi Sea. He was in Kotzebue, which is a really important island to look at the impacts on, but he wasn't near where Shell is drilling. So that's as far north almost as you can get. And the farthest northern village is Barrow, which I think most people maybe have heard of. And just slightly over to the left from Barrow is where Wainwright is. But as the president was arriving, there were 30-mile-an-hour winds out where Shell is drilling, and they had to stop drilling and bring one of the rigs in because it was too dangerous to be out there. And that didn't get any coverage. I read it in Upstream Daily, I think, which is an industry magazine about upstream drilling, upstream parts of the oil sector. So that's why I knew about it. And basically, it lasted the period of time that the president was there. One of Shell's rigs, the Noble Discoverer, had to come in, and the Polar Pioneer had to stop drilling. And that's just typical of what it's been like out there. So Wainwright is the closest village. It's the drilling where Shell is at is 70 miles from shore. Yeah. And Wainwright is about 550-person Inupiaq Native Alaskan village that is still primarily based on subsistence living. They're dependent on whale hunting, seals, caribou, polar bears. Where when I was there, you know, when I walked around, basically, you know, just the presence of how much life was dependent on these resources was so clear. There was hides everywhere, skulls, drying meat, you know, just sort of the presence that people are living in and off of the land and the water is very apparent. But also so is Shell. So Shell is already appearing in the community. Hmm. They already have a 60-person workers camp. They're called man camps because it's mostly men who come in. And that's already set up. A private company had taken over the only hotel in the village, and the prices went from a sort of normal rate to $350 per bed per person. So I shared a room with another person and paid $350 for my bed in Wainwright. So prices are obviously being affected. Wow. And they're expecting to bring in a 300-person man camp soon. You know, the risks to Wainwright are very real. People are very, very concerned of a spill. The Obama administration's own agencies have found a 75% chance of a spill happening out there. They're very aware of the BP oil spill and the impacts there, and particularly to subsistence communities that do live in Louisiana and surrounding areas. And they're very fearful at the same time. And I'm writing an article on this right now. At the same time, the leadership of Wainwright has actually signed a fairly historic deal with Shell, giving the community and many of the communities of the North Slope an actual financial stake in the drilling. So people who spoke to me were very nervous about doing that when they talked about their fears. But when we sort of found a place where they felt like they weren't being watched, expressed deep concerns about Shell's drilling operations there.
Does Shell hire any locals, or is everyone brought in?
There are some locals who are doing some jobs for sure, but primarily, I mean, certainly not offshore. There's no, you know, offshore drilling skill base among the native Inupiaqs of Wainwright. Those jobs will be people shipped in, and they'll be shipped in for 2 or 3 week stints, and then they ship back out. Which is also, you know, an important question I was asked recently is, you know, how does money come into the local community? And it's not from the workers. So for example, that hotel that I stayed at, a private corporation owns that hotel now. The money doesn't stay in the community, and also the workers, you know, primarily their families are somewhere else. Their families are in Mississippi or Louisiana, and they, you know, go and work out on the rig for a couple of weeks, stay in the man camp, and then spend their money at home, you know, taking care of their own families.
Antonia Yuhas is an award-winning investigative journalist and author of 3 books, her latest Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill, and Kate Shepard, senior reporter and environment and energy editor at The Huffington Post. We're talking about media coverage of President Obama's trip to Alaska and the Arctic and his environmental policies, which He gave Shell the green light to drill in the Arctic. What are your thoughts on how this story is being covered, how President Obama's trip to Alaska got major headlines this week? What did you make of that? And then what do you think, what are your thoughts on how his environmental policies are being covered? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Wanda in Berkeley. Hi, Wanda. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've read the Chronicle and I've read the East Bay Express talking about Obama, and it's basically the same take that you're presenting, which is that Obama has a very good record on global warming and climate change policies. But for some confounding reason, he's allowing drilling to go on. Well, basically what's happening here is that those who are behind climate change and global warming mitigation are the same people. They fund all the environmental groups, and that would be the same people who own oil companies. So they want both of those policies, and they play both sides. And Obama is simply the person that's getting the job done right now until, you know, somebody else gets in office that they put in. So I think people need to be and I think this kind of reporting actually enables the going on of the corruption of this whole topic of resources and how the control of them that is had by those who own oil companies. And, you know, it would be nice to hear the names of the people who own the oil companies. It's just the oil companies, the Chevron, blah, blah, blah. Well, there are individual people who manipulate everything, and they're the same people who make war.
Well, Antonia, you cover the oil industry extensively. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I guess the most important thing I would just say is I don't find it confounding that the president is talking both about positive things about climate change and increased drilling. It's emblematic of his policies, which he's called all of the above energy policy. And basically, it's sort of as you're somewhat suggesting, which is, you know, he get support from the oil industry. The Democratic Party gets support from the oil industry. The administration is trying to, you know, in many ways have its cake and eat it too. I genuinely believe that President Obama, if not members of his administration, are concerned about climate change. I also think he and they are politicians. And the oil industry remains, even with the fall in the price of oil, you know, one of the wealthiest, most powerful industries in the world. Its voice on public policy is incredibly still quite dominant and quite difficult to get away from and not to follow, particularly if you're the president of the United States. So I think that it's not confounding. It is, however, deeply schizophrenic if you want to try to actually do something about climate change.
And Kate, what are your thoughts on that? What would you add?
I mean, I think Antonia is absolutely right. I think that this is part of the Obama administration's overall energy approach. I think they're doing these two things at the same time. She said it's a very schizophrenic approach. And I think that is a result of politics in Washington, and it's a result of I think the administration trying to walk a fine line on keeping people happy and doing both things at once. They have overall supported drilling, not just in Alaska, but in other parts of the U.S. off the East Coast, and I think they see this as them trying to sort of do both those things and make everybody happy.
And Wanda, to your point about the CEOs, there was a great report from the Institute for Policy Studies which found the top executives at the largest publicly held oil companies in the U.S. have made $6 billion in the last 5 years. It named names. ConocoPhillips head Ryan Lance, ExxonMobil head Rex Tillerson topped the list, $27 million and $33 million respectively.
Yeah, that's a great report.
It's not getting as much attention as it should, but it sure, I mean, this report's very extensive. I also wanted to ask you both, I mean, talking about the people involved, you know, thinking about the people that you met when you went to Wainwright, or Kate, the people that you met in Shismaref. I mean, these villages are really changing drastically. The impacts are very real. Do you think that that element got into the reporting this week?
You know, somewhat. I mean, I think that because the president went to Kotzebue, because he went to Dellingham, because he had, you know, native speakers at his events, you know, I think he was personally trying to talk about the impacts of climate change on these communities. And as I said, you know, it was one of the, I think, just scariest moments of the trip when he was in Bristol Bay talking about the need to protect communities from oil drilling at the same time as he opens oil drilling in the Arctic. It's, you know, it's just, it's a really excellent reflection, I think, of, you know, where public policy is at the moment where, you know, somehow it's okay to keep drilling when it is carbon that is obviously, you know, the heart of the problem. And I think that, you know, the impacts of maybe something that wasn't really talked about enough is the struggle of these communities, because they are, you know, Wainwright is also falling into the ocean. They have to keep moving back their houses because of coastal erosion as a result of climate change. They're also deeply impoverished. Mm-hmm. You know, just as Kate was saying, where she was at, it's a deeply impoverished community. There is, you know, a difficulty in relying on the old ways, while still a great deal of food and income comes from subsistence hunting. It's you know, more and more and more difficult to survive in that way, and so they are looking, you know, trying to find other routes for economic development. And you know, I've covered the oil industry all over the world. I've been to communities, you know, from Afghanistan to Ecuador, who talk about these promises of what oil development will mean, and they talked about it in Wainwright too. You know, education, healthcare, roads, schools, and almost never are those results brought to bear. And so that, you know, the sort of hope that's there is also a sad part of the story that isn't told. Those hopes and expectations that are, you know, most often dashed when the development actually does come.
Right. And one villager in Siwalak, an inland village of 900 people, they've been trying to locate for 10 days to higher ground, but they've struggled to find the money to do it. And a resident told the New York Times, quote, "Our village is going to be underwater." So that says it all. Kate, final thoughts on this issue and just the human side of this story?
Well, I think it's important that the president highlighted the struggle of Alaskans, but I also think it's important to note that you don't have to go all the way to Alaska to see impacts of climate change here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. There's coastal communities in Virginia and Louisiana who are facing very similar threats, and I think it's important that there be continued pursuance of federal answers to these problems. It's still a challenge that is sort of diffused throughout different administration offices, and there's not really there's really no central office that's in charge of figuring out how do you help these communities and these people.
Kate Shepard is a reporter with the Huffington Post. Antonia Yuhas is an investigative journalist and author of three books, including Black Tide. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How does fair trade coffee affect the lives of small-scale farmers? On the next Your Call, we'll rebroadcast a conversation we had about Connected by Coffee, a documentary about the lives of the people who grow coffee. Over a billion cups of coffee are consumed every day. The industry is worth over $100 billion, but most rural coffee growers live in poverty. So what can we do to support farmers using fairly traded coffee as a tool for social justice? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.